I guess you're all here to find out something about the Crusades and to get some answer to that question, whether the Crusades are over. I thought I'd put a few things on the board because in some ways they're the most important things I have to say this evening. They may not be answers, certainly not very direct answers to the question whether the Crusades are over, and they may be things, at least the top part, that many people would disagree with. But they're basic positions that I hold. I hold those positions, if I could say it, theologically. I hold those positions because my life has told me this. Yes.
You can't read it.
The proposition here is there are no unmixed goods. For human beings, in terms of living with other human beings and making choices that are very important, there are no unmixed goods. There are really, if you think about them and you reflect on your own bad experiences, the most evil experiences in some way have some dimension or some proportion that's good. I hold those two propositions for just about everything. And I want to have those two propositions as part of my discussion of the Crusades historically, a collection of events that happens roughly 11th, 12th, and 13th century, which has a kind of revived existence in the 15th and the 16th century, which again has a kind of revival in the 18th, 19th, and continuing this day, even though we don't call it Crusades anymore, from the Christian side. And the Muslim analog or parallel can be put under this word, this term, jihad, J-I-H-A-D. Sometimes it's transliterated with an E, J-E-H-A-D. Most of the time it's translated as holy war, just as we sometimes have the synonym holy war for Crusades. The Crusades was the holy war of the Christians to recover the holy places from the infidels. That is, from the Christian point of view, the infidels are the Muslim. The Muslim engages in jihad, a holy war against the infidel. In this case, the infidel is the Christian. Now, part of it, of course, is playing on the English language. Then the other basic theme that I hope permeates our discussion tonight is a play on John's a gentle justice, and this is Gentile justice. That is the justice which we as Christians must seek to express toward both the Jew and toward the Muslim. This is another way of coming back to the basic theme of the children of Abraham. That is, Jews, Christians, and Muslims. From the point of view of Muslims for a long time, and now somewhat more frequently from the point of view of some Christians, and occasionally it's used for Jews in their discussions, that we are all three people of the book, or some book, the Old Testament and the New Testament, for the Christian, the Old Testament for the Jew, and for the Muslim, the Old Testament, the New Testament, and the Quran. Now, some of you heard me try to emphasize this in earlier presentations before we had the forum last night. That is very important for Christians to realize, for anybody to realize, the man on the moon should realize it, that from the Muslim's point of view, he is a continuation of what God had prepared for all humankind, first in the revelation to the Jews, as expressed in the Old Testament, then sort of updated in the New Testament, but unfortunately corrupted or misunderstood by the Jew and by the Christian. then to be clarified further and reconstituted through the revelation that God gave to Muhammad and eventually transcribed in Arabic in the form of the Quran. Those of you that were here last night know how much I tried to emphasize that from the point of view of many Muslim world figures today, both Gaddafi and Khomeini, the Quran is very much like the Bible as interpreted by some of us. The Bible is an inerrant source revealed to us with the solutions for all kinds of problems, personal, familial, national, international. Same for the Muslim. Now, it's very easy and too easy to say, well, we're right about our book and you're wrong about your book. That's too easy. That goes against my basic propositions. That even in the good book, how we interpret it, how we use it. See, I'm not going to get into the problem of saying that from some point of view, it's not perfect, but it's always used by the creature. It's either interpreted by us, by our ministers, or by the community, and the same for the Muslim. So the next thing I'd like to do is review a little bit of history with us. The first part, I put one date there, because as you could tell last night if you were here, sometimes I start the answer question and I never stick on the point, I move off someplace else. Dates are important, and that might be the most important date for us, because it isn't just simply a date. My purpose is to emphasize a point, that in 1076, some Muslims took over the holy places. They took over the holy places. The people who lived in the holy places in those days weren't by and large European Christians. They were Oriental Christians. They were often Christians who, from the Western European point of view, were heretical, schismatic, or not so good. Very important point. Pilgrims came. They were West Europeans. Pilgrims came from the Byzantine Empire, too. But European Christians, by and large, did not live there at the time when some Muslims took it over. The Crusades, in part, were justified, and as military expeditions, were attacks against the Muslims controlling the holy places. And sometimes the Crusaders, of course, were joined by other Muslims fighting Muslims. I can't go into the details of it, but just remember that there were 9 Crusades, plus a children's crusade, over a period of more than 2 centuries. 11th, 12th, 13th century. By the 12th century, the enthusiasm of the first Crusades had been dying down. I'll try to go through a few details of this to try to emphasize my basic theme, that what is from one point a noble cause, the crusade to recover the holy places, to protect the lives of pilgrims, to protect the sanctity of the holy places, in practice becomes very much corrupted. So before we can really answer our question whether the Crusades have ended, we have another kind of question that we will hopefully think about and not answer, whether in some ways Crusades should end. There are Crusades and Crusades. There may be Crusade A and Crusade B. Crusade A may be good both in terms of its end and acceptable in terms of its means, where Crusade B might have good end but terrible means. And from the point of view of a fairly standard Christian ethics, it has to be criticized. Yes?
Could you say something about the military activities of Muhammad himself in the 8th century? I mean, was there some continuity between what he did he captured Medina in Saudi Arabia or something? Was that related to the takeover of the holy places or not?
Well, it's relatable in terms of historical continuities, but not very directly to Muhammad. Muhammad gets his revelation from God over a long period of time. It's calculated maybe 20 years. And he's not young. He's in his 40s when he's first realizing that he has a special role to play. So Muslims believe that that was given to him through the angel Gabriel. I don't want to be funny or try to be a sarcastic or anything, but he heard it in Arabic. Now, we have our jokes too about our Christian Bible sometimes that it's, you know, it's in Latin or God revealed in King James English or something like that. So he's an Arab. He doesn't know any other language, so he hears it in Arabic. And then he preaches it. And it's what he has preached to other people that eventually is recorded as the Quran, written down as the Quran. When he first starts preaching, some of you have heard this before, they think he's kind of odd, because what is he preaching? Well, among the things that he's preaching, in Mecca, the place where he was born, Mecca, a pilgrimage center for pagan Arabs. I don't like the word, but that's a standard word we have. The pagan Arabs who practiced idolatry. They were polytheistic. They practiced infanticide. From Muhammad's point of view, one of the worst sins they engaged in was murder and tribal conflict. So those are the kinds of things that he preached against. Taking on a quasi-Marxist role for a while, we say, well, obviously, the Meccan merchants and the people who had the stands for their, supplying the needs of the pilgrims didn't like his idea of taking away the pilgrimage place. So he eventually is forced to leave. His life is endangered, and that's why he leaves Mecca and goes to Medina. Muslim tradition says that when he's left Mecca, he hardly has any converts. His first convert is his wife, a slave which he manumits. That's an important aspect of Islam over the long run, that it permits slavery, but it always encourages the idea of freeing the slave. And again, discussions of that, in order to be fair, would have to consider all kinds of particular cultural contexts. So he has a very small group of adherents or believers in his message when he goes to Medina. But Medina accepts him, and it accepts him in part because he exhibits one of the characteristics which seems to be an important characteristic of Muhammad. He was a diplomat. He helped resolve internal difficulties in the city of Medina, and therefore he was welcomed. That enhanced his prestige. His message was more clearly accepted. Now, the traditions about Muhammad include a number of cases where people had problems and they were just about ready to choke each other, and he comes along and he solves the problem. The traditions about him are quite interesting, because they don't present him as being absolutely selfless, that he wasn't like Solomon and comes up with some clever way of getting people, or at least one of the sides, to admit what the situation is. He's just in the sense that both sides are satisfied with his solution, but he gets something out of it. Now, that seems to be a good diplomat. You not only solve the problems for other people, but you get something for yourself, something you can parlay or use later on. So after a period of approximately 8 years in Yathrib or Medina, he goes back and recaptures Mecca. And in the process of recapturing Mecca and establishing his teaching, to use the language of Montgomery Watt, who's a major Christian scholar of Islam today, who's a real specialist in the early period of Islam, Muhammad is the statesman. So from being the prophet, he has been transformed into a successful businessman, prophet, to almost necessary political leader quote statesman. I sort of like that word, you know, because we have these cliches about he's not a statesman, he's only a politician. So we have this sort of vague notion that somehow statesman is better than being a politician. Then Islam spreads. Now here, the interpretations of the spreading of Islam are diverse even among Muslims. Muslims would tend to say, with God's blessing, these Arabian tribes that were first converted will eventually convert other Arabian tribes. Then they would be accepted or convert by the sword other people in Arabia and moving east toward the Byzantine Empire. So by the time he dies, there's a fairly big territory under the control of Muslims, Arabs. Let me put it this way. My interpretation is the control is under Arabs, led by the Quraysh tribe, that is Muhammad's tribe, who are Muslims, and in the context of the society of those times, the use of force after trying to convince someone by reason doesn't seem so awful as it does to us today. I don't want to justify that, but in the context of the time, military and religious expansion was common. I briefly alluded to that, I think, last night, that the expansion of Christianity in the early centuries wasn't just by hermits and the holy men preaching the gospel. That often when a political leader was converted, everybody joined him because he was the leader. It was good to do it. It was prudent. And if he wanted to get a little bit more territory, the territory that he conquered would become Christian. Again, it's a part of our history which we tend not to want to face up to, or we sort of forget. But there is no great determination, as far as I can see, in the intervening centuries from the death of Muhammad to really take over the holy places of the Christians. There is no determination to do that. Their holy place is Mecca. That's their holy place. It only later becomes a holy place because of subsequent events subsequent to the life of Muhammad. Does that help with the question?
Yeah. From what Muhammad himself said, was his intention in this expansion primarily military or religious?
Well, I would say that his intention is primarily religious, that he sees himself as the instrument of God. And God is very concerned at that time to reform and to enlighten societies. Remember what I said last night, quoting from Gaddafi. Where Gaddafi says the East had been pretty well corrupted. Then the Quran comes and raises us up. And if we permit ourselves to deviate from the Quran, we'll fall back into the kind of paganism that we had been a part of before the Quran that came. So with that kind of understanding, Muhammad too says, this is a religious teaching which is quite ethical. Now here again we have some problems when we try to use our Western categories. Christian philosophy, I know there's a whole debate, is there such a thing as Christian philosophy, but assuming that there is Christian philosophy, the Christian philosophers often say we can make an important distinction between religion and ethics. That there's kind of natural ethics, that there's something about revelation that adds to it. But basically, we can have an ethical system just through a natural reason. Islam has never permitted itself to have that as an acceptable position. Some philosophers have moved that way. Theologians, or what we could call theologian in Islam, never moved that way. That those kinds of distinctions, that is, between the natural ethics and revealed ethics, between the public and the private, as I said last night, between the church and the state. Though they have been discussed in later times, it was never part of the society. And again, well, you have to be a little bit of an anthropologist to sort of see this, maybe. That the nature of those societies just does not permit what are relatively modern conceptions. Think about American history, the Pilgrims, what you learned about New England, Calvin's Geneva. Is there any big distinction between the secular and the religious in those situations? We often are very anachronistic when we examine societies other than our own or a past history. So my position would be he's motivated primarily by religion, but religion is not separated from a politics. It's just too intermixed. But the spread of Islam, we know historically, can't be explained simply by armies of Arabs or armies of other kinds of Muslims attacking countries and forcing everyone to be a Muslim. That used to be a common way to try to explain the spread of Islam in so many parts of India. More careful scholarship shows that however important forced conversions were in India, it couldn't explain the very large numbers of Muslims, particularly in the northwest part, in the northern parts of India, because anthropological study, even blood study and stuff, shows that they were converts. They were converted by peers, by merchants. If you go to South India on the coast in what's Kerala, the dominantly Christian part of India, find a group of Muslims that have been there long before the rest of India was Islamicized. They became Muslims exclusively through the Arab traders. Before Arabs themselves were Muslims, they came to that part of India as traders. When the Arabs themselves became Muslim, they intermarried or they had families on the Indian coast, and gradually they were converted, they became Muslims. They're called Mukhlis. Special name for me. A significant Muslim minority in South India doesn't come into existence at all by any kind of a use of the sword, but by conversion. So I don't want to deny that Islam had been spread in various ways by the sword, but it's a great oversimplification. And it raises our hair unnecessarily as to what is the fuller nature of Islam. And what I think is more important, the character of Muslims as people. Every once in a while now, I've been asked, well, what does Islam say about this? Very often, I really want to say, Islam doesn't say anything about it any more than Christianity says this about whatever the question is. A person who identifies himself as a Christian says this is what Christianity means. The same for Islam. A person who's identified as a Muslim says, this is what Islam means, or this is what Islam means to me, or this is what my group says Islam means. And when you look at what the Muslims have said at various times, just as what you look if you look at what Christians have said at various times, there certainly is a lot of core agreement, but some significant deviation or variation as to how those basic truths should be applied someplace. So I think what I'm really trying to say is we have to be truthful. Islam is spread by the sword. We have to be truthful. Christianity has been spread by the sword. We have to be truthful. Buddhism has used the sword too. You don't have to know too much about the history of Buddhism to know that whatever the Buddha might have said, whatever the Hindus might have said about ahimsa, it was spread to by the sword. Because human agents use or interpret or misinterpret the religious traditions or ethical traditions that they have. Well, maybe I'll just try to say a few more things about the Crusades historically to try to emphasize the points I had already indicated.
Excuse me, did you say there's good and all evil?
No, I said there are no unmixed evils. That means even the most evil thing, if used in a certain way, can provide some kind of good. Take something like the Holocaust, a very large term to describe the systematic effort on the part of Nazis and others associated with the Nazis to, if not completely exterminate the Jews, to make Jews as a race or as a group inconsequential or just simply slaves in the future. That's a major evil, a complex evil of modern times, which has its roots and its origins, God knows how far back. But haven't we had some great examples that have come out of that? You go to the library, a significant proportion of the relatively small library is devoted to Bonhoeffer. You go to the bookstore, you see how many books there are in Bonhoeffer. Now, Bonhoeffer could have been a great and inspiring person if there had been no Nazis, if there had been no Holocaust to follow. He sort of even antedates in some ways the Holocaust. But you see what I'm saying? If you want, if you make the effort, you can derive, you can see something that will be good or useful for you. Because it seems to me in some ways, if you did believe that whatever the boundaries you put on the reality and you called it evil, and it was absolutely evil, you'd really have to be a pessimist. You couldn't exercise the virtue of hope. I don't see how you could. I mean, that's just my position. We could, you know, move away from the particular issue at hand and talk about that abstractly. But it just seems to me that you can't. But putting the philosophical thing, the philosophical theological element apart, it just seems practically to be a good principle to have. Because it gives you an opportunity, really, to look carefully. It should force you to ask some questions about, is the end, take the good, for example, is the end that I want, go back to what we had last night, the end that we want nationally is elimination of international terrorism or domestic terrorism. Laudable end. But you start thinking about, why is there the terrorism? What are the various means that can be used to end the terrorism? Or then you look at what seems to be evil or fairly unmitigated evil. Abu Nidal, one of the major international terrorists, the coordinator, mastermind behind so much of it. If you just look at him and you say that he's absolute evil, then I'm afraid that you will use means which, if not absolutely evil, are so mixed with evil that you have to ask yourself whether they in fact are good means. And that's part of what I'm trying to say about discussion of such a long historical thing as the Crusades. That the Crusades as a historical phenomenon are a very mixed thing. When I first started thinking about the talk, I saw all my effort was to say bad things about the Crusades. That it's something that we should face up to, how bad they were. But then as I started thinking through the things, I thought, well, yeah, you've got abstractly this principle that you've held for a long time, that there aren't any unmixed goods and any unmixed evils. See whether this applies to the Crusades. Then I take it possibly the question means that you're skeptical about what I said. Would you want to add a little bit more or say why you think that I should rethink that proposition?
Well, even with your terrorists, from their point of view, it isn't evil. It's evil from our point of view, but from their point of view, it's a good thing.
Well, I'm not sure. Occasionally I read an article, The Mind of a Terrorist. We have very little opportunity to know whether a terrorist thinks that it's good. Every August, for some years now, we reflect on the dropping of the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And in those reflections, we often have some pilot or some navigator, somebody who was involved. And what they say about what they did on those days causes me to think that some of them I've heard say, oh, I knew that it was evil. I didn't have any idea that it was evil. But I also know that it was good. It saved lives. See, they said it saved lives. I knew that it was bad, but it was also good. So if that's possible for guys on our side, isn't it possible, guys, on some other side? See, I don't even like to say on the other side, see, but on various sides for someone to say. I'd prefer to do otherwise, but this seems like this is what I have to do now. So it's right in one sense, what you said, but I don't think it really says enough about the psychology of engaging in what we call terrorist acts. They're atrocious acts. They're atrocities.
Couldn't communism be a pretty good example? They say that they want peace, but they will do everything they can to attain it, which means murdering or killing or whatever.
Well, I'll go back to what I said before, that there are all kinds of people who have called themselves communists and people who today call themselves a communist. Included among the communists I know personally is a Methodist pastor who'd been a missionary in South America for a long time. He's an active member of the Communist Party. Yeah, he's an active member of the Communist Party. Now that causes problems for him. He's that bishop that wishes he would go someplace else. But for some various practical reasons, I like him, but I don't think he's very practical in the way he's construed reality. I mean, I would think, you know, better be a democratic socialist or something like that rather than a member of the Communist Party, even though that might not be too practical. But what I'm trying to say is he identifies himself as a communist. He would never legitimize the use of violence to have a communist regime. We know in Eastern Europe there are people who call themselves a communist who also simultaneously are Christians. And they're not fudging. They're honest about their Christianity. I've been to Cuba, and I've met the people who, for a long time, didn't want to be communists. Now, say, yes, I'm a communist in a certain sense. I would never join the Cuban Communist Party. But I'm willing to call myself a communist because of certain values that communism stands for and for something that has happened in Cuba. Not that it's perfect, but from a number of points of view, it's better than what had happened before. So, again, I would say, at least analytically, one doesn't get a satisfactory answer by looking at abstract ideologies. You have to do that sometimes, but as Christians, it's more important, and I think as political beings, it's more important to see what people do in practice, what they say and what they do in practice, and not have our answers or our beliefs in terms of abstract systems. Let's make a big jump. Capitalism. Does capitalism have to mean absolute indifference to the welfare of those you're competing with? I think for some people, that's an ethic that's part of capitalism. But there are others who are Christian capitalists, and they would say, no, you know, there's a limit to what I will do to benefit myself. But if a communist defines capitalism, what he does is characterize it, caricature it. And often that's what happens when we try to describe or say something about an ideology. We really caricature it. We emphasize the things that we know to be wrong. We emphasize the things that we dislike. And we forget to make the comparisons where it's quite similar to the things that we like that are part of our system. There was some other question.
Yeah. Observe that your principle there probably would probably apply it to people as well as events. So there's good in some good in the worst of us and some bad in the best of us.
Yeah, it might be hard to see it. That doesn't mean that I would disregard prisons. I'm not a person that says, you know, open up all the prisons and let them all run out. You don't have to go that far. What it might mean is when you do have a prison situation, ideally we would do more to understand the motives, the situation of people in the prison. Yeah. Are there any more questions? The questions sort of eat out to some part of what I had originally planned to say, but I'm just as happy to work with the questions maybe as to try to go back to.
I don't know if you've talked about this yet or not. How does the Quran compare with the Bible in its teaching? And then how does the Muslims look upon the Christians? Do they accept us as we need to learn to accept them?
Well, how does the Bible and the Quran compare? From some points of view, they're very difficult to compare. What you will find is more contrastable things than comparable things.
Such as what would contrast?
Well, the stories in the Quran often seem quite disjointed. Often they seem to be prayers that don't fit too well together. There aren't, first of all, if one would say, what's the similarity and the difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament? Already you'd have a big problem to say, well, you know, certainly lots of differences between the Old Testament and the New Testament. There seems to be greater similarity between the parts of the New Testament than the various parts of the Old Testament. So the Quran provides stories and exhortations about how to live. But it provides most of all, I think, sentiments regarding God and your attitude of worship toward God. And the rules that Muslims have for their religious ritual are not specifically in the Quran, but derive from their own practices and belief and the traditions about what the Prophet wants. But if we could be quite general, the Quran has stories which would indicate that you should be very generous. That's a very common theme in the Quran. So generousness would be something like charity. The Quran indicates that you should be concerned with members of your family. The Quran indicates over and over again that what you should do should be motivated by love of a God. So let me just jump away from that. In Islam, there are lots of people who sometimes are referred to as Sufis.
S-U-F-I, plural, put an S on.
Sufi. And sometimes that word is translated or explained as a mystic or mystical. But what it means in many situations is a person who leads people in a religious way, in a spiritual way. Often the mystics have been poets, philosophers, writers. In some cases, they seem pretty ignorant. They're sort of like the stupid holy man, you know, the ill-educated, the holy person, the person whose great goodness is preserved because he hasn't been corrupted by knowledge. What makes him good is because he knows what people are and what to do for people. So you find Sufis like this and legends about them. So one of my favorite stories about a Sufi is one of the earliest Sufis who happens to be a woman. And the story about her is, in one hand, she has a bucket of water, and in the other hand, she has a lighted torch. And someone says, "Hey, what are you up to?" And she says, "Oh, I'm going to burn down heaven and put out hell." Now, the purpose of this story, you see, is to emphasize that you do things not for reward, either material or spiritual, but for the love of God. If there's no heaven to prompt you to do good, if there's no hell to dissuade you from doing bad, then it has to be pure devotion to God. The Quran really emphasizes a lot of that in terms of the story, that God is the most important thing, if we can put it that way. God is the reality, so your life should be ordered to do service to God. It's a little bit, in some ways, like important parts of liberation theology today, or the social gospel. I would say that over the centuries, to some degree, that emphasis has been lost. And some of the Islamic teachers and public figures that we most dislike today because of their international politics are the ones who emphasize that point. That our societies have become so corrupt and so full of injustice that that's why we have to get back to the original Quran, why we have to get back to the example of the four caliphs, the people who followed Muhammad as the combination of religious, political teachers. Because a little bit like our notion of apostolic times, before things were so corrupted, they too have a kind of apostolic times, that is the period of the four righteous caliphs, where people did follow the Quran, they did follow the example of Muhammad, they did do what God wanted, just as the earliest Christians supposedly did follow the gospel, did follow the example of Christ and the apostles, but later on institutionalized, become corrupted.
I think what I was really wanting to know in the Quran, since they are children of Abraham, or so to speak, mm-hmm. are there similarities in their teaching of Abraham that, yes, indeed, we are basically the same stock, although separate?
Well, that's in the Quran, but I think many Muslims over the centuries have not particularly emphasized that. Maybe similarly, as many Christian theologians over the centuries emphasized that there is a New Testament, and the continuity with the Old Testament in somehow is underemphasized, and one emphasizes, oh, the Old Testament's got this God of wrath, now we got this God of mercy. So I think, again, for the Muslim, if you've got a religion which is the new revelation, there will be a tendency to emphasize what is new and distinct. That doesn't mean that you don't recognize that part of the tradition, but you're going to emphasize the newer aspects, and then that's also tied in with the recognition of conflict politically between the Christians and the Muslims. I said a little bit about those periods and places in the Middle Ages, particularly Spain and Sicily, where there was the tripartite culture, where Christians, Jews, and Muslims worked together philosophically. They could have their disputations, they could have their arguments, but they lived in a kind of synthetic culture. Sometimes under a Christian ruler, more often under an Islamic ruler. And that's important too in terms of what I was trying to emphasize here. That the First Crusade depending on how one you want to interpret it, instigated by Peter the Hermit or by Pope Urban, says, okay, let's get the Holy Lands back. In the process of trying to get the Holy Lands back, they're a little bit diverted and try to do some domestic European politics in Hungary and a number of other places. So the real crusade, I mean, it was a fantastic, insane thing, the First Crusade.
Not as crazy as the Children's Crusade.
Maybe not as crazy as the Children's Crusade. That's the crusade that comes approximately the time after the Fourth Crusade, where children from throughout Europe were induced to go to the Holy Land to recover the holy places. Some of them went by ship. Almost all of them were sold into slavery by, in many cases, Christian shipmasters or crews. Another gang of them were primarily from Germany and took the land route. They never got to the Holy Land. They died of disease, hunger, and starvation. So there's the warning that crusades may have a good end. We have Christian crusades against various things. We have crusades against pornography, etc. There may be good ends. But sometimes enthusiasm causes us not to use the reason that we should have. It causes us not to be cautious. It often causes us not to exercise responsibility toward the people who need some kind of guidance. A lot of them followed Peter the Hermit. Peter the Hermit got most of the peasants. I'm pushing a little bit far. Very often what happens when you have some kind of a military thing or the opportunity to do something, if you don't have a job, you don't have any money, hey, here's a chance to get out of my poor situation. So run off, join the army, run off with a crusade to the Holy Land. So that's where a good hunk of them went. The later crusades, more organized, with the princes, happened some months later before it makes its effort to go to the Middle East. But what originally I was going to have done was sort of say a little bit about each one of the crusades, but to sum it up, the crusades were a military failure in the long run. Not only military a failure, but they did two other things. I oversimplified, but I should bring them up. They killed a lot of Jews, particularly in the organizing of the earlier crusades. Partly as a consequence, some people in their analysis say that the ignorant and the peasants were organized by itinerants and firebrands. And since it was going to be a little bit of time before we got across the Mediterranean, the Jews were at hand. Then some of the princes had problems in terms of their own territories. So they used the crusades to solve some of the problems there. But most importantly, one of the crusades sacked Constantinople. Remember how I started off? Some Muslims took over the holy place. That the Christians in the holy places, the permanent residents by and large, were not Western European. The Western European crusades zapped, if I can use that current word, Eastern Christians in the Byzantine Empire. It wasn't particularly concerned with the Oriental Christians in the Holy Lands, in the Arabs. It's never been really that concerned with them until quite recently. When the Protestant missionaries go to the Middle East, very often the Presbyterians and Catholics at first, but later on everybody else, they weren't going there just to try to convert the Muslims. We already were feeling sort of the reverberations of the Crusades. Well, we didn't do too well there, and there was the idea that the hardest kind of people to convert are the Muslims. You know, it's better to get a pagan and work on him. Maybe a Hindu, particularly if he's an outcast, work on him. Muslims are a little bit more difficult. So let's try to straighten out these heretical, non-mainline Christians. So they often went after them. So that's part of the mixed heritage of the Crusades. There are many things about the Crusades that are kind of interesting. Let me just point to a few of the questionable ones and then some that might be positive. Since the post became very important in organizing the Crusades, and since there was a special kind of oath of the Crusader, in which the promise was made that a person would engage in a crusade sometime within his lifetime, he didn't do it have to do it immediately, and that he would do that under the guidance of the papacy and armies controlled by the papacy, even though there was much confusion and no clear line of command in terms of the various crusades, it did ultimately strengthen the nature of the papacy as an organization, and very much in terms of money. Because after a while, when people say some knight or somebody, for legitimate reasons by the oath, couldn't make the crusade immediately, and the whole enthusiasm for it was dying, he could have it commuted, we might say. He could get out of it. He could join a religious order. He could do some kind of good work. Or, like older systems of draft in the United States, you could pay your way out. So those monies went specifically to papal coffers for the organizing of later expeditions. But as I said, after a while, there weren't any more expeditions. You couldn't get anybody to do it. They didn't want to run over there and take a chance. So that collection of money still stayed with the papacy. It had a lot to do with the Roman Catholic notions of absolution and indulgence. You know, the whole sacramental system was affected by the Crusades. Then let me point to what some people would see as certain kinds of I haven't exhausted these things, but a few positive things, which became important in the Reformation, not so much in the Reformation, but more in the Renaissance and Enlightenment later on. People looked at Muslims in a new way after a couple centuries, and they said, here are people that have a refined and high ethical system, which is not derived from Christianity. They've been worthy opponents in war, and in many cases they have been worthy allies. I want to emphasize again that the Crusades wasn't just simply a matter of Christians fighting against Muslims. It's too complicated for that. There were Christians using Muslims against Muslims. There was Muslims using Christians against Muslims. There was Muslims using Christians against Christians. I mean, it's all part of the Crusades over the 2.5 centuries. So this contact with the Islamic societies caused some people to say, well, you see, you can have a good ethical system and it not be derived from Christianity. As rationalism and skepticism and enlightenment became more important in the West, this was another example, along with certain people's interpretations of China and Japan later on, to develop our whole systems of natural ethics, or ethics independent or distinguishable from the Christian ethics. Then there was all this loot that came to Europe. That's a common part of wars in many cases. It can be anything from some Nazi medal to somebody's helmet to other kinds of things, you know, paintings, etc. So these things were brought, and they changed certain artistic styles. But maybe the most important thing was the revival of Aristotelian knowledge. The Arabs' use of Aristotle, Aristotelian knowledge, medicine, mathematics. Now, Muslims like to throw that in our face today. I use that expression purposefully, because they go to extremes in trying to tell us, see, you wouldn't be as advanced as you are today if it hadn't been for those earlier Muslims. What they really mean is some Arabs who happen to be Muslims who were involved in this.